From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Washington in December during a transition is historically a crazy mad rush. This year, well, yesterday, President Trump released a 46-minute video diatribe of baseless fraud claims. Staunch Trump supporter Lindsey Graham turned heads when he said on Fox that doing a video is not proof. You've got to take it to court, which the Trump campaign has tried many times with only one win. And in Congress, the logjam seems to be breaking on a long-awaited coronavirus relief bill. Let's take that up with NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
Well, yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi endorsed that $908 billion bipartisan compromise plan that was floated this week and that Democrats didn't like initially. They wanted more. So how significant was her endorsement?
Well, I think it's interesting to frame the endorsement more as an endorsement of a start of new negotiations. She's basically saying that the Democrats are willing to come down from the $2.2 trillion ask that they had for many, many months, saying that was the bare minimum that they were willing to consider. Now they're saying $908 billion is where they should start to have conversations with Republicans. Now, this is really significant because the difference between $908 billion and the $500 billion that Senate Republicans are talking about is so much smaller than trying to get from $2.2 trillion down to $500 billion. You know, part of this is, you know, Democrats are seeing a different administration on the very near horizon. And they've been hearing from President-elect Joe Biden that he views anything that Congress does right now as, he called it, a down payment. It is a signal to Democrats that he wants them to get something done now so that there is a little bit of breathing room, an opportunity for them to work on a next step. Part of the reason they didn't ever want to do anything, Democrats didn't want to do anything that was incremental in their minds or was just a small piece of the coronavirus relief process, was that they didn't believe that President Trump would ever follow up with an additional bill. I've been talking to Democrats who say, you know, that's different now, and they're willing to do something smaller because they anticipate that more relief is in the offing.
Yeah, well, 20 million people currently receive some kind of special federal unemployment benefits. They expire the day after Christmas, Grinch. The compromise bill would provide $300 a week for 4 months instead of $600 that the Democrats have been holding out for. So is there wiggle room there, are you saying? Or
I see. The thing that is, we're at this point with these negotiations where everything is kind of up in the air. But this $300 is quite close to things that Republicans have been talking about. We mentioned the $500 billion that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has endorsed. The Republicans are open to doing additional funding for unemployment benefits. Now, where things will actually land is really hard to say because as the conversations have barely gotten started, which is kind of a crazy thing to say right now, but with the year being so close to an end. But as you were saying, in Washington in December can sometimes be a mad dash, and it's entirely possible that those numbers could begin to change just in the next coming days.
Oh, well, speaking of mad dash, just in the minute we have with you, we want to ask you about President Trump's dash scheduled to go to Georgia. Now, in Georgia, two lawyers, Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood, told a crowd of Trump fans not to vote in the upcoming Senate runoffs because they said falsely that it was fraud. Newt Gingrich said that was totally destructive, but he's also ginned up claims of fraud in the past. And President Trump is headed to Georgia to support the two Republican candidates in these runoffs. What are you hearing, if anything, from Republicans on the Hill about these mixed messages? Vote, don't vote.
Republicans largely have tried to avoid getting too deep into telling the president how he should or shouldn't be talking on Twitter. It's something that they've learned over the course of these past 4 years, that it doesn't always work out to their advantage. They want the president to come and help people show up to reelect these senators in Georgia. They say everything is on the line there, but they've been very cautious about how they have that conversation.
Yeah. Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional correspondent on Washington and its mad dash. The next few weeks, we will see a transition. Kelsey, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, in his victory speech days after the election, Joe Biden thanked black voters for helping him win the White House.
The African-American community stood up again for me. You always have my back, and I'll have yours.
Well, now there's some concern that Biden isn't making good on that promise. At least seven civil rights groups are pressing to meet with the president-elect, including the NAACP and the National Urban League. They want Biden to name more black leaders to top jobs in his administration. Mark Morial leads the Urban League. Mark, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And if and when you get a meeting with the president-elect, what will you tell him?
So importantly, we look forward to a direct communication with the president-elect, and we're going to reaffirm our interest on behalf of the community that the number of diverse cabinet members, particularly African-Americans, are prominent in every level of the Biden administration, cabinet, sub-cabinet, as well as at the White House. You know, we want to give the president-elect due credit. He chose an excellent running mate, Senator Harris. He's made an important appointment of Cecilia Rouse as chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and Linda Thomas Greenfield as UN ambassador. But we're heavily focused on what's known as a statutory cabinet, defense and justice and transportation and commerce and labor and HUD and education and HHS, for example. That is where the important levers of power are. We're going to communicate that to him. And the second thing we'll be communicating is our interest in the public policy arena. We need aggressive enforcement of civil rights laws. We need strong investments through both stimulus and infrastructure plans. And we need a focus on long-term issues of racial justice, criminal justice reform, police justice reform, just to name a few high priorities. And finally, with respect to COVID, we need to ensure that the vaccine is safe and effective for all people, and that there is a community-based distribution system to ensure that people in our community have access to the vaccine.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is if you are actually concerned with what you've seen so far, or if you're just trying to get ahead of the process. As you point out, there have been many black officials appointed to key jobs, and the Biden administration says they're not done yet.
I think it's both, and I think it's there have been two statutory cabinet nominees thus far, Treasury, Homeland Security, as well as the State Department. And that's important. And we do have a concern, and we do want to get ahead of the process. And we want to be clear that we are looking for a cabinet when it comes to African Americans that meets but really exceeds the high watermarks of the Clinton and Obama cabinets. This is a different time. And the president-elect has made an important public commitment to racial justice. And I believe he's serious about that. But to execute that, he's got to have people who have lived experiences as well as professional qualifications, along with connections to the communities that have borne the brunt of the country's systemic racial injustice.
Look, there's no doubt having a diversity of opinions from all walks of life is critical in any leadership role. But make the case why race matters so much here. Ben Carson, I'm thinking of Ben Carson, a black housing secretary. I assume you don't agree at all with his policies. And many black leaders at the same time are saying that outgoing Senator Doug Jones, a white man, would make a great attorney general because of his record fighting for civil rights.
So let me say this. Ben Carson is a great doctor. I never thought Ben Carson was qualified to be Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I thought he would have made a great Surgeon General. He'd have made a great Secretary of Health and Human Services. I think it was an example of picking a quote-unquote black person and putting him in what some perceive to be a black position at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And I think it was a mistake, and I think it was a disservice to Ben Carson. So, I mean, it's important to understand this is not just about a black face in a certain place.
So you could easily make an argument that black voters helped deliver the White House to Joe Biden. Is there a political consequence, in your opinion, if he gets this wrong?
Yeah, I think there's a significant political consequence, and that is a non-enthusiastic African-American community in the 22 election cycle, a non-enthusiastic African-American community in 2024. You know, there's deep distrust and cynicism in parts of our community towards politics in general and politicians writ large. The idea that people promise extravagantly and deliver meagerly, that they say one thing on the election trail and change their tune when they must govern. And I would be less than frank and candid if I didn't tell you that the eyes of the communities and the eyes of the nation are closely watching how the staff and the cabinet evolve, and more so than ever before.
Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League. Thank you very much.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks. Always good to be with you.
It's hard to come up with an aspect of life unchanged by the coronavirus. Socializing, the way we get together with people or don't. Travel, work. Now, these will presumably return to some kind of normal. But what about aging? How we age, where we age, the tools we need to age, and the finances. Wall Street Journal reporter Ann Turgeson spoke with tech experts, gerontologists, financial planners, psychologists, end-of-life experts, and they all saw changes to aging that might not reverse because of the coronavirus pandemic. Her new article in the journal is How COVID-19 Will Change Aging and Retirement, and she joins us now. Ann, welcome.
Sure.
You know, for a lot of people, if they're not there yet, this is research. You know, this is peering into the future, as you have. So let's just plunge right in. Number one on your list, more people will be aging at home. This is after 40% of Americans who died of COVID-19 died in care facilities. In fact, you talked to people who said many nursing homes may be going out of business.
Yeah, so that was just the number one answer that people had when I threw the question out, you know, how will COVID change aging? You know, it's sort of shown the shortcomings of institutionalized care, where we have seen a huge amount of COVID-related deaths. So, you know, looking at the future and the possibility of future pandemics or future outbreaks of some kind of infectious disease, there's just not a lot of confidence in that as a solution for people.
Well, the other thing is that adult children, I think, are going to be traumatized for a long time by not being able to see their loved ones. I mean, I can hear people saying never again. Nursing homes and care facilities are still going to be invaluable for people who can't care for people at home. But talk about some of the resources that people are eyeing now more. I mean, this idea of Medicare programs, like Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, that's a Medicare-sponsored service, or the idea of expanding Medicaid and paying home health aid workers more than, as you remind us, the $17,000 that's the average annual income for a home health aide. Talk about some of the things people are thinking about.
I mean, the thought that a lot of the people I spoke to have is that we're going to end up with higher quality nursing homes. At the other end of the spectrum, you know, more people who can stay at home will stay at home through programs like the acronym is the PACE program. It's a jointly paid program by Medicare and Medicaid. It's helping only about 50,000 people right now with needs like medical services and adult daycare and home care and transportation. The thought is that that could be expanded. If the finances were there, it could enable a lot more people to stay at home.
Yeah. Well, and it costs, you know, maybe $7,000 a month instead of $9,000 a month for someone in a nursing home. So it is cost effective in the long run.
Also, the fact that a Medicaid program right now is experimenting with paying some family caregivers. And another thought is that that could be expanded.
Oh, so if somebody's taking care of a loved one, they would get paid for that. But there's also a trend that you write about towards smaller group homes. Talk about that.
Yeah, so one of the people I spoke to for this article is a guy named Bill Thomas, who has done a huge number of very interesting things in his life, one of which is to start something called the Greenhouse Project. These are smaller, very home-like care facilities where up to 12 residents will live together with open floor plans and big dining rooms and fireplaces and open kitchens that everybody can work in together. They have done fairly well thus far through the pandemic in terms of their infection rates. So these are thought to be a better model for the future. Of course, it's more expensive.
You say all older people are benefiting from a technology boom. There are wearables. There's Zoom. There's telemedicine. Tell us more about that.
A lot of people I spoke to have said that being on lockdown has spurred a lot of entrepreneurs to think about what people will need in order to exists better at home as they age. Telemedicine is one of the examples that we've seen really take off.
Well, and many people growing older are really moving towards healthier lifestyles, maybe feeling lucky that they missed COVID-19. So there's all these wearables to track blood pressure, to track glucose levels. There are apps where you can call for help. You write about new ways to avoid isolation.
Yeah, I love some of these ideas. I think people are getting very creative. You know, one of these companies, it's called Discover Live, I believe. They have these virtual kind of tours that they can take you on that are live streamed, and there's an actual tour guide there who can answer your questions and take you to different places. And then there are other companies. There's a company called Eldera that pairs older adults with children who need homework help. I know as a mom, I could have used that assistance. And one called Table Wisdom, which I thought was a great idea, where foreign-born students are paired with older people who are willing to kind of just sit and have a conversation with them so they can improve their English. Those are some of the ones that I just thought were especially creative at connecting people and also connecting people across generations.
But I want to talk about savings because people have been impacted here as well. Will you tell us what's the biggest impact on people from COVID-19 having to do with their finances?
Yeah, so it's not a pretty picture. I mean, obviously the stock market has been up and, you know, that's a good thing. But we've seen bond yields decline. And in general, that just makes it a lot harder for people, especially people in retirement tend to really hold a lot of bonds for very good reason, you know, because they're a lot less volatile than stocks. They're more predictable. A lot of people, at least a generation ago, relied on bond yields to support themselves. They would, you know, they would live off the yield and leave the underlying principal. That's just not realistic anymore. So the idea is that just because you don't get a very good return on those investments, you need to probably save more. And there are people who are saying you might need to even save 20% more in order to live on what you project that you'll need. And at the same time, Social Security is facing potential shortfall in its trust fund looming in about a decade. And COVID has actually impacted that by about a year. So the trust fund is expected to become depleted a year earlier than we had thought before. So overall, it's not a very pretty picture for the financial situation of many retirees today. You know, this may cause people to just work longer.
Work longer. Well, you spoke to somebody at AARP. It sounds like they're saying before you put money in a 401k, which might be hard to access, if you're funneling some savings anywhere, your employer might have more flexible saving accounts that you can have access to for emergencies. And we're going to link people to your article because this is the first place I've really understood the 4% rule in your writing, which is how much you should withdraw from your savings in the first year of retirement. You lay that out. But meantime, you know, all of this is about making people more mindful, more conscious. You know, what you land on, Anne, is that people are really thinking, yeah, get my house in order, get my finances in order, figure out where my house is going to be, but then concentrate on what? Relationships, people I haven't been able to see.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pent-up demand to socialize. And as the doctors I've spoken to for this article point out, socializing is not just something that we enjoy. It's actually really good for our underlying health and potential longevity. So it's really important for us as social beings to be able to do that eventually. One of the silver linings of being in a sort of semi-lockdown kind of existence is that people do, because their regular routines and their regular busyness has been sort of disrupted, people do have time to sit and think more consciously about, you know, the things that make them happy in life and the things that they really would like to do, you know, not just as a way of kind of filling the time that you have, but as a way of maybe leaving a legacy. And I've talked to many people who say that people are much more deliberate in their planning of this type of thing.
Another result that you hear from experts of COVID-19 is that the aging are planning for death. I mean, people didn't get a chance to. And so people are, you say, are really trying to take a hard look at that end of life.
Yeah, as with many things, I think COVID has kind of sped up the, you know, the focus on that. More people are embracing resources that can help them with that. And it sort of sounds like, well, you know, what is there to it? But there, you know, there are multiple steps that people should go through, you know, from filling out powers of attorney that enable somebody else to make medical and financial decisions if you cannot, to just really thinking about what kind of end-of-life care do I want? Do I want doctors to be able to do everything possible to try to keep me alive? Or do I want to draw that line somewhere and say, you know, beyond this point, I don't want medical care? And it's very helpful to families, because then when a family's actually in that situation, as so many have been during this pandemic, they can kind of default back to what the person's wishes were.
You know, a ventilator might have been an abstract thing before, and now we know what it is when you decide whether or not you want it. By the way, Ann Turgeson of The Wall Street Journal, as you were researching this, you sound pretty young. Did you find yourself thinking personally about a lot of this stuff?
You know, I have been thinking about a lot of these things because I'm not that young. I'm 55 years old, and actually I think I'm 56 and time flies. But a lot of these things have been on my mind, in part because, you know, my parents do live in an age segregated facility and I haven't been able to see them, and I have been in lockdown, and, you know, I have teenagers and it's been hard to manage them, and I have to think through how much risk do I want to take. And you know, now that I have no commute, I do have more time in my day to think about longer-term goals of mine. All of us maybe have had that experience, but these things have affected my life as well.
That's Wall Street Journal writer Ann Turgeson. Her recent article is How COVID-19 Will Change Aging and Retirement. We'll link you up to everything there. Ann, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, December 10th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
The surge of COVID-19 cases is putting pressure on supplies of tests for the virus, but some scientists think they can help to more carefully target who should be tested by using sounds hidden in human vocal cords. Brett Dahlberg with IEEE Spectrum reports.
Dimitris Spathis has been listening to people cough for months, but he's not a doctor. He's a computer scientist.
Specifically, I'm working on AI or machine learning.
Spathis and his team of researchers at Cambridge University in England are trying to build a computer program that can detect signs of COVID-19 in people's coughs. And in their breaths. And their voices.
I hope my data can help manage the virus pandemic.
Spathis says his team has collected about 25,000 audio samples from 10,000 different people.
We even have some participants that were with us before they got sick. And then we can see the progress, and we can see how your cough is changing after you got sick. And then you recover.
Spathis says spotting respiratory symptoms in vocal samples can help companies flag people who need additional screening for COVID-19, instead of requiring everyone to get tested or relying on self-reported symptoms.
It's a very simple app. We just ask people to cough, to breathe, and then to read the sentence in their own language.
The Cambridge team is one of several around the world trying to nail down the sound of COVID-19. David Liu's company Sond Health has an app called Sond One. It asks users for just one sound.
It'll prompt you with a little countdown to hold the sound for 6 seconds.
Liu and Spathis both stress that their apps do not make a diagnosis. They say it's about probability. The apps are meant to flag people who sound like they probably have COVID-19 so they can get follow-up testing and diagnosis.
We want to give people that early warning system that something's going on here, you need to pay attention.
Liu says the differences in sound at the early stages of a respiratory infection are so subtle that they're not discernible to the human ear. But artificial intelligence can pick them out. Heather Matty, who teaches biostatistics at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, says getting the programming right is key. She says the algorithms behind the apps need to be based on a broad sample of people.
AI applications in healthcare can be great, but we also need to make sure that they perform the same for different groups of people, because we all know that COVID-19 is hitting certain groups more severely than others.
Black Americans are more than twice as likely as white Americans to be hospitalized or die from COVID-19, according to the Federal Centers for Disease Control. But Maddie says there's a long history of leaving black people out of statistical analysis in medicine, the kind of analysis that apps rely on when they compare someone's vocal samples to those of known COVID-19 patients. She says without careful planning, machine learning can go awry, leading to false positives or, worse, false negatives.
When you're training and you're testing out your algorithm, you definitely want to make sure that it's performing equally across all groups from the get-go. It might not be doing what you think it's doing.
Lou and Spathis both say they're working hard to gather data that's representative of the entire population. Lou says, like much of his work, it comes down to the numbers. More voice samples from more people means more accuracy for the algorithm and a better chance of keeping contagious people away from others. For Here and Now, I'm Brett Dahlberg.
The planet is heating up dangerously faster than scientists expected. 2020 is on track to be one of the three warmest years in recorded history. And yesterday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued a dire warning.
To put it simply, the state of the planet is broken. Dear friends, humanity is waging war on nature. This is suicidal.
President-elect Joe Biden says he'll make the climate crisis a priority on day one, and more than 40 major U.S. corporations, including Amazon, Walmart, and Ford, are now calling on Congress to work with Biden on climate issues. Last week, General Motors said it was dropping support for a major Trump administration effort to weaken auto efficiency standards. President Trump had tried to roll back California's strict fuel regulations, the toughest in the nation, which the Obama administration had championed. Mary Nichols, top climate regulator in California and chair of the California Air Resources Board, joins us now. She's at the center of this contentious issue. Mary, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you.
And I know you spoke with GM's CEO, Mary Barra, just before she made the announcement. Do you have any insight? Like, what did she tell you about why GM abandoned the Trump administration on these fuel standards?
She told me that they'd made the decision and that she was very pleased about it, and they were looking forward to working with us on the next round of standards and moving the country forward towards electric transportation. She did allude to the fact that she knows Joe Biden and had a relationship with him when he was the vice president. He had visited their headquarters and had ridden with her in a Corvette. And, you know, she felt very good about where he was going to lead the country and was looking forward to it.
Yeah. Do you think it was, I mean, just the fact that the Joe Biden won the election? Because, I mean, the economics of the issue of clean vehicles didn't really change much in the past year, did it?
No, I don't think anything significant has changed other than the political direction. But they always made it clear that they have issues with the Obama standards that they would like to see fixed, but that they were being pushed by the Trump administration to roll back further than they thought was useful or necessary, and that they also were going to side with the Trump administration because they have a lot of dealings with the federal government. But they do recognize the reality that this president and his administration are going to want to work with California on matters relating to environment, global warming. And so they're not going to be suing us anymore to try to keep us out of it.
Well, in GM's letter, the company urged other carmakers like Toyota that had also sided with the Trump lawsuit to join them. What do you think the effect would be if even more automakers follow California's rules, which, in short, I should say, is that fleets must average 51 miles per gallon by 2026.
The benefits of the California program in terms of savings of fuel and of greenhouse gas emissions are enormous. We're really trying to make a difference with respect to our planet. And the most significant thing we can do is to reduce emissions from our transportation system. So we've got to work on that. The fact that other companies are now beginning to look at joining is certainly encouraging. But ultimately, when the Trump lawsuit goes away and California's authority is restored, the federal government is also going to be rescinding its efforts to roll back the regulations. And so we're going to have a discussion, which includes the industry, about where we're going next.
Right, because one of the complaints from carmakers has been that the federal government needs just one standard and not have California be off by itself. Do you think that will happen under a Biden administration?
Well, it happened once before with Obama that California and the federal government sat down together and adopted standards which are not identical, but which are completely aligned so that companies who met the federal standards would also comply with the California standards. We could get back to that kind of a situation again, but it will take some work to iron out the details.
Well, as you know, the Trump administration said these tougher standards were bad for the economy. They made cars less safe because they made those cars lighter. What do you say to that and to people who might also argue that these stricter standards would essentially mean Americans won't be able to buy things like new trucks anymore?
All of that is hogwash. It's just not true. The industry has shown time and time again that they can make vehicles that people want to buy that are also clean and fuel efficient. The only thing that's changed is that we now see a future where most vehicles and soon all vehicles are going to have either a battery or a fuel cell or be advanced hybrids, because our economy and our environment need that kind of long-term commitment to electrification. And we're going to have to work together to make that happen.
I'm speaking with Mary Nichols, head of the California Air Resources Board. But just in a couple of days, your term will expire, and your name has been floated as a front runner to lead the EPA. What do you think about that? Would you take that job if it were offered to you?
I've said before that I would be delighted to work with the president-elect and his team in any capacity they wanted, as a volunteer, as a staff member, or whatever. And I think that there's a tremendous opportunity here now, but it's going to be a lot of work to undo the damage that was done to the environmental programs over the last 4 years. Even the agencies themselves have suffered really significant damage in terms of people who were their most important career professionals who've left because of inability to work under the political leadership that they were given in the Trump administration. So it will take some work to rebuild. But having spent time at EPA myself in the Clinton years under Carol Browner, I am very confident that EPA will be able to snap back and frankly, be better, given both the new leadership coming from the White House and the recognition on the part of the American people, which is really the most important factor here, that climate change is real and that we need to be getting on with the business of taking action to deal with it.
Well, to add some context to what you just said, the Trump administration rolled back at least 80 Obama-era policies, things like fuel efficiency standards, which we just spoke about, restrictions on mercury emissions, clean water restrictions. Again, saying they're too difficult for corporations to meet, they're too costly, they're going to cost jobs. What would the number one priority on day one be, in your opinion? You say it's going to be a lot of work. Where do you start?
There's already a good list of priorities of things to start working on first. And of course, reversing what Trump did is only the first step, because we've got to move on in a number of key areas, including the vehicle emission standards.
Joe Biden has said he's going to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord on his first day in office. I assume you're very much in favor of that, but you know, emissions were already growing too fast to meet the original goal of keeping warming under 2 degrees Celsius, and you have just lost 4 years under the Trump administration. What do you do to make that up?
I think the most important thing the U.S. can do is to send the message that climate change is back on the agenda and that America is going to lead. One of the first and I think most heartening signs of Joe Biden's commitment here, of course, he ran on the issue and he made it one of his top four priorities. But in all of his phone calls with global leaders that came in after the election, the topic of climate change came up in virtually every one of them. This is not about just the U.S. Starting again. It's about offering to work with other countries to address this problem, because it isn't just a U.S. problem.
Right. When you step aside at the end of the year, what do you want your legacy in California and beyond to be?
I hope it's a legacy of showing over and over again that we can work together with industry, with labor, with community organizations, mayors, to advance environmental protection and do it in a way which not only doesn't hurt the economy, but actually helps to produce one of the most vibrant economies on the earth.
Mary Nichols, outgoing head of the California Air Resources Board, and on the short list, apparently, of Joe Biden's choices to be the EPA chief. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
There were more postponed games this week, more players testing positive for COVID-19, teams violating safety protocols. Stop me if you've heard this before. Well, you're going to hear it again with Mike Pesca, Here Now's a sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi, what a promise. What an incentive to listen.
Well, but actually, I want to start with something we haven't talked about. The dispute between the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and U.S. Soccer Federation. This week, the two sides reached a settlement over working conditions. They left hanging, you know, pay equal to the men, but still progress.
Yes, it is. So the suit, which was alleged to have been a pay disparity of $66 million, that was thrown out by a judge. And he looked at the numbers, he looked at the differences in pay and said, you haven't even prima facie proved your case. But that left unaddressed this indisputable issue that the women's travel, the women's accommodations, and this is really important, the fields that the women's that the women played on were inferior to the men. Mm-hmm. And the new head of the soccer federation acknowledged that. They worked it out between the women's national team and the federation itself. And so all those things, which really do have a big effect on safety, all of those things will be addressed and equalized. And this also means the actual suit for the money can be appealed, although legal experts say when a judge throws out a suit like that, an appeal is a successful appeal is very unlikely.
Well, that was going to be my question. So you're saying that they're probably not going to get any further on this equal pay dispute?
This is what the legal experts that I surveyed last time told me and said. But that doesn't mean that in the future, the Federation in and of itself and with negotiating with the team can't equalize pay. But the issue of the back pay seems to be, if not a dead issue, it would be very unlikely that an appeal of that sort of summarily dismissed case would be successful.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a look at the impact of COVID-19. Football, the Saints and Patriots have been fined six-figure sums by the NFL for violating COVID-19 protocols. The Steelers-Ravens game rescheduled three times before the teams finally played yesterday. Could we see the NFL go into a bubble?
It will be very hard. There are so many players and personnel involved in a team. And also, right now, the NFL probably thinks it hasn't done a bad job when it comes to COVID. And you could make the case they haven't had to cancel a game. That is true. They haven't had to cancel a game. In order not to cancel a game, they postponed that Steelers-Ravens game three times and put it at 3:40 in the afternoon because it was a tree lighting ceremony already scheduled on NBC. And 20 Ravens players were not available to play because of COVID, and it made the competition quite unbalanced. And then if you look at what happened in the Broncos game, where all of their quarterbacks were out, and they had to pull a wide receiver up off the practice squad, ask him to play quarterback. He had more interceptions than completions. Great, they haven't canceled the game, but they haven't actually fielded competitive contests all the time. I do think a bubble is unlikely. Yeah.
Unlikely. But the, you know, pro basketball went into a bubble in Orlando. And let's talk NBA. They start their new season December 22nd. That seemed to be successful. Are they going to be in a bubble again?
They will be doing, I guess you could say, a modified version thereof. I mean, they're looking at travel schedules. It won't be as strict as the bubble that happened. They're looking at travel schedules, and they're trying to limit contact. It's a 72-game season instead of an 82-game season. They made less money than last year because of fewer games, fallout of ratings. So the contracts won't be as big. This is having an effect of player signings. So, I think the NBA, there is more good faith on the behalf of the players towards the NBA because they did such a good job. The other leagues, and we haven't even talked about college football, I think they are right to question the wisdom of their leagues. But everyone is trying maybe as best they can to get through this.
Yeah. Okay. I want to note two historic figures. Sarah Fuller made history, the first woman to play a Power 5 college game this past weekend, a place kicker for Vanderbilt. But I just want to take a minute for someone who's already taken his place in history. Rafer Johnson. He died yesterday at 86, the first black captain of a U.S. Olympic team. He won gold in the decathlon in the 1960 Olympics, championed the Special Olympics. And many of us remember he wrestled Robert Kennedy's assassin to the ground in that awful moment in 1968 in Los Angeles. Just a few seconds. I hate to do it, but your thoughts?
Yeah. Hero and an icon. And it also speaks to a time when the Olympics and track and field were dominant in our society. What a contribution to America in so many ways.
In so many ways. Mike Pesca, you're now a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And if it's a new name to you, please Google Rafer Johnson. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.